One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hello and welcome to the very latest episode of Unfiltered, which features the person who has probably, in the early days of this podcast, been requested by more people than any other as a potential subject for the interview. I speak, of course, of John Ronson, and he will be talking a lot, but by no means exclusively, about his latest project, The Butterfly Effect, which is a seven-part audio series, or podcast, as the kids call them, looking at the changing nature of the porn industry, which might sound a little bit sort of sleazy and or vicarious, but it's actually anything but. It's absolutely fascinating, and it begins, really, with him seeing a hotel receptionist, the way that the receptionist looked at a porn star that he was meeting in his hotel in Los Angeles for a different project. And just from that tiny seed, this is one of the things I love about Ronson, from that tiny seed, you know, hours and hours of first class, first person reportage evolved. We'll find out how now. So welcome to Unfiltered, John Ronson. It's a genuine pleasure to have you here. Mm.
As I had a mouthful of tea, it's lovely to see you.
I started that deliberately as you reached for your mug, as the first sip past your lips. I thought I'd dive in and start the tape. Let's begin with when we last met, because you came on my radio show about a year ago, almost to the day, and Donald Trump had just been elected U.S. president. I made a clumsy attempt to blame it all on you for bringing Alex Jones kind of into the mainstream.
Yeah, but you know what? He would have he was going to make it without me. With or without me, Alex Jones was going to make it. Although I have been held responsible for Trump's rise a couple of times over the last year, because I was the man who kind of gave the world Alex Jones for the first time. And then, you know, extraordinarily, Alex suddenly gained power because Donald Trump was a fan of his, you know.
Have you spoken to him since?
Alex, we text from time to time. I've been kind of poking around his world the last year or so, and I haven't done anything with it, and I don't know what to do with it, but Alex got wind of it.
Okay.
And left a long voicemail message and texted me, and I think trying to work out whether I was
what your angle
was, whether I was friend
time.
Or foe.
He's quite symbolic, actually, of the things that interest you, isn't he, in a way? Because you're trying to almost make sense. You presume there must be a point at which a penny will drop when you investigate these people and everything will make sense. But part of the charm of some of your work is that possibly it never does, because it can't.
Yeah, Alex is kind of a wall that you end up just banging your nose against. You can't break through, especially because Alex has kind of got worse over the 20 years. You know, most people you would think, you know, when they accumulate the flotsam and jetsam of life's tragedies, become more empathetic more sort of, you know, understanding of other people's issues. But Alex has kind of descended rather than ascended over the last kind of 20 years.
I suppose he'd argue that it's working. So why on earth would he retreat from the position when it's earned him the ear of a president?
True. And he, you know, I think Alex does care about his ethno-nationalism.
His ethno-nationalism. Yeah. This, of course, was in Them, Adventures with Extremists, and you came back to it in the Kindle book last year.
The Elephant in the Room.
Adventures with Extremists, oddly, I mean, it's almost ended up casting Ian Paisley in the role of the moderate, hasn't it, in the aftermath, because the other person that you spent time with for that was Omar Bakri Mohammed, who you saw as quite a comical character, and yet who has been seen to have inspired genuine, now, sort of 16 years later, he has inspired genuine terrorists.
And now Omar Bakri's in jail in Beirut in solitary confinement, possibly for the rest of his life. And his son, his very sweet little boy, Mohammed, who I remember being within Hyde Park like 20 years ago, and he was saying how scared he was that his father was going to get into trouble because he'd just watched the biography of Malcolm X, and he was worried that his father was going to end up getting like assassinated. And poor, sweet, you know, lovely little kid, I don't know what age he was, but maybe 12, 13, something like that. I really, you know, empathized with him a couple of years ago. He joins ISIS and then gets killed by ISIS. ISIS turn out to be terrible bosses.
Yes.
But I felt really upset when I heard that.
Of course.
Like, poor sweet kid, you know.
Never had a chance.
You close your eyes, you open them again, and he's an ISIS fighter getting murdered.
The world has turned. Yeah. If we then sought to sort of identify what prompts you to paint a target on something, what's your kind of thinking on that front? For me, the Men Who Stare at Goats, possibly, which is where you looked at the American Army's employment of weird new, that possibly is any definition of a Ronson topic I can come up with. Sometimes I think the Men Who Stares at Goats undermines the definition.
Yeah, I think so. The Men Who
Stare at Goats. Oh, do you? Wow.
Yeah, no, I agree. The Men Who Stare at Goats is the only thing I ever did under pressure.
Right, okay.
So I always think of it as like the kind of, you know, of all of my children, it's the kind of errant sort of child that's sort of a bit disformed.
Because thematically, it's everyday craziness that interests you. That was the subtitle of your Guardian collection.
Yeah.
And The Men Who Stare at Goats is anything but everyday craziness. It's standout, extraordinary craziness.
Yeah, well, there's a few reasons why I don't love The Men Who Stare at Goats as much as the other things that I've done. It's probably, I kind of love everything I've done.
Of course.
Kind of, and there's bits of The Men Who Stare at Goats I really like, but I basically don't like it as much. For a few reasons. So what had happened was I'd just had my first hit. The book Them had come out, and there was a documentary series to go alongside it called Secret Rulers of the World. It was the first time I'd ever done anything that was a hit. You know, Them had made it into the bestseller list, and Secret Rulers of the World was getting like great reviews and big viewing figures. And I didn't know what to do next. And my basically Channel 4, and this has never happened really to me since. And I'm glad, even though what I'm about to say, well, it's a poison chalice, basically. Channel 4 said, here's £500,000. Do, you know, go off and make some more films. And I was like, even then, I was like, this, I don't think this is going to end well. Because at the same time, there was this guy called Matt Collingstreet. Do you remember Matt? He's an art critic. He made this amazing show called This Is Modern Art.
Yes.
And BBC or Channel 4 said to him, like, here's some more money, make some more. And he then made this terrible show called Hello Culture.
Right.
And I was thinking, shit, I hope whatever I do next isn't going to be Hello Culture. and it was kind of nightmare. We were going back and forward to America, not getting anything. I was like going crazy. I was getting like living in constant motion sickness, missing my kid growing up. We'd go like all the way to America and we just wouldn't get anything usable. We were like flailing around. So it was really unpleasant and stressful. And then finally we found the story of The Men Who Stare at Goats.
Yes.
And that felt like a real breakthrough. But I tell you what the problem was. I went through no personal change doing that story. Everything else I've done, I've gone through a change. Like with the psychopath test, I became a kind of, you know, like a sort of power-crazed psychopath spotter, which then gave me the ability to like tell stories about how mental health labeling can be kind of tyrannical.
Yes.
And the same with, so you've been publicly shamed. I kind of completely changed my mind about, you know, outrage online. And But with the Menasteric goats, like, I never believed it was possible to kill a goat just by staring at it. So I could never tell the story in the kind of empathetic way that I always like to. I could never truly get inside their heads because I never believed that those powers were real.
That makes perfect sense to me then. I was a little nervous about suggesting that it might somehow stand out from the rest of the canon. And we'll move on to the Butterfly Effect, the latest project, which looks at the kind of proliferation of a new kind of pornography, but does fit the same parameters of finding out how extraordinary things are unfolding in the same environment that you live in. I think most people have got a sort of John Ronson pivot moment where they realised, they realise you're a bit special. For me, it was the article that you wrote about the hypnotist disciple, when you wrote so honestly about your own genuine crippling fear that every time you weren't with your wife and child, something terrible was going to happen to them, and you wanted to eventually find a way of training yourself out of that mindset, and it took you into the world of sort of not Paul McKenna, but that type of
Paul McKenna was involved
in it, isn't he?
And Richard Bandler. It's true. I used to suffer from a kind of crippling anxiety that if I couldn't get my wife and son on the phone, they were dead.
Yes,
and I would picture how they had died. Sometimes when my son was really young, my wife had fallen down the stairs, was lying at the bottom of the stairs with a broken neck. A kettle was boiling and my son was reaching up for the flecks of a just boiled kettle as I was phoning and the phone was ringing out. Honestly, I just felt really upset just even remembering that.
Well, obviously, and it was that level of self-examination that made me think, crikey, this is a guy I should be reading every week. So I did. And that would be, how long ago would that be now?
My son's 19 now.
Yeah, so pretty much most of his life ago.
Yeah. So Paul McKenna kind of cured me. He hypnotized me and cured me of when my wife didn't pick up the phone, I no longer think she's dead. But I never asked him to cure me about my son because he was just a baby at the time. So I couldn't kind of imagine that one day he'd be old enough to pick up the phone. So now, if I can't get my son on the phone, I still think he's dead.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. So Paul McKenna half cured me.
and what that perhaps suggested to me was that you think that by completely, almost sort of with unbelievable levels of honesty, by examining a subject, in this case yourself, by going in so completely, you might achieve some sort of solution. You might achieve some sort of resolution. And when if you can do it with your own life, as you attempted to do in that, which was only ever a magazine article, I think.
Yeah, it ended up in a collection I wrote called Lost at Sea, but it was just going to be for The Guardian.
And if you can do it with your own life, then that almost to the date, because you'd had your film about clubbed class, trying to blag your way into the jet set, your book rather, into the jet set lifestyle. But as you say, your first hit was Them, Adventures with Extremists. It was almost as if you then took what in the column was a forensic examination of your own existence in search of answers, and then you moved it on to forensic examinations of much bigger mysteries in the hope of finding answers.
Yeah, I think so. I think the reason why I started writing about myself and my own frailties was because I felt very annoyed with people who do the kind of thing that I do, but from a position of moral superiority.
How do you mean?
People who consider themselves like representatives of righteous society. So for instance, I'm trying to think of a good example. I feel very anti-hierarchical. So the kind of story where somebody like me would, go to, say, a neo-Nazi compound. Mm. No, neo-Nazi compound's the wrong. That's the wrong example, because
we can all. There is an objective.
Exactly, they ought to be taken down.
Porn's not a bad example.
Yeah, porn is a very good example. Because I've just done this year-long adventure into looking at the tech takeover of the porn industry, and pretty much every journalist who goes into the porn world does it from a position of moral superiority. The porn people are not humans to them, by and large. They're kind of ingredients in their preconceived ideology of the story that they want to tell. Mm. And the story could be about how porn is bad, or it could be about how porn performers are all exploited. But there's always some prejudgment. And when you fill your head with ideology and prejudgment, what there's no space for curiosity and a kind of shared humanity.
You're trying to fit the facts to your preconception rather than trying to find them out for yourself anew.
Yeah, and you know, I used to do that when I was younger to an extent. You know, but I kind of matured my way out of it. And so the reason why I sort of write about my own frailties is because I think it puts me on a level playing field with the people I write about who are more obviously frail.
Rather than having that kind of artistic distance, you're writing from inside the tent.
Exactly. And, you know, rather than that kind of I'm better than you. Or the thing I really hate is like when the journalist is like, in a sort of unspoken way, is like, I am normal. I am the norm. There's a line towards the end of So You've Been Publicly Shamed where I say on social media we like to see ourselves as nonconformists, but all of this is creating a much more conformist, conservative world. Yeah. You know, look, we're saying we are normal. This is the average. Mm. We are defining the boundaries of normality by tearing apart the people outside of it. And, you know, that's why I'm against some shaming campaigns on social media, because it's doing that. Whereas if you ask about your own frailties, then you're not a representative of conformist conservative society. You're on the same, you know, you're on the same level playing field as the people you're writing about.
It takes a degree of personal confidence, though. You mean, because it's almost contradictory to describe the anxieties that you have suffered from, but also to be comfortable enough in your own skin to expose it all.
Yeah. You know, I think mental health stigma has really changed just in my lifetime.
Yes.
I think people who were, you know, I remember growing up in Cardiff, like if somebody had like mental health issues, they were like the kind of, you know, crazy person down the street that you wanted to avoid. And I don't think people really feel that way at all anymore. I think a whole bunch of people came along, and I was one of them with anxiety, but, you know, other people with, you know, depression or, you know, whatever it was that they were, you know, that they had, who were just very open and honest about it. And I think that sort of move. That
changes
sort of,
everything. Do you know, it's emerged entirely unintentionally as something of a theme in these, you know, we're still in the first dozen episodes of Unfiltered, but in the early days, from odd people like Russell Brand leading into Alistair Campbell, but all speaking to the same truth that you just described, that simply by talking about their own problems, in their cases, addiction and depression, and actually a fair degree of crossover, it normalizes it.
Yeah, absolutely. And they probably feel the same way that I do, which is that, well, why hide it? It's like it's a part of the human condition, and just, you know, it's no more shameful than any other part of the human condition.
No, or any other illness. I mean,
exactly, any other illness. You know, the way I see it, as long as somebody isn't cruel to another person, then everything benefits from empathy and compassion and curiosity.
What was your childhood like in Cardiff? What was John Ronson like growing up?
I was a very banal and unremarkable, remarkable only in the sense that I was very unpopular.
Were you?
Yeah. And at Cardiff High School. I have no doubt that that's followed me around my whole life, you know?
How did the unpopularity manifest itself? Were you hung up from the coat hooks, or were you
basically,
just...
Yeah. I remember one time I was blindfolded and my hands were tied behind my back and I was stripped and thrown into the playground at Cardiff High. That's probably as bad as it got.
Yes. What's in your mind when that's happening? How are you?
At the time,
yeah.
I was like, just can't wait to get the fuck out of Cardiff.
Make it stop.
Well, I was always, I always suspected that everything would be okay in the long run.
Why?
I don't know. I had a sort of confidence in my... I always thought I was going to do okay in life.
Confidence in your talent, you were about to say.
Yeah, I thought something. I'll tell you what really helps. My grandparents lived in London, in Portman Square, just next door to Selfridges, quite fancy.
I say.
When they died, we thought we're going to make some cha-ching money out of that flat. But then it turned out they were on a lease and it wasn't right. freehold. And it was like 5 years left on the lease.
Yes.
So we made nothing.
Yeah.
Right. But because they lived in London, I spent, you know, frequently during my childhood, I would, you know, go to London. And when I was like 13 or 14, I would just... my parents and, you know, my grandparents would all be sitting and chatting and I'd like leave the room and I'd have no money on me, but I'd get on a bus for as long as until the bus driver asked for my fare. And then I'd jump off the bus and then get on another bus. And I would just spend like entire days doing that, just going around London on different buses, jumping off and jumping on and jumping off.
Exploring.
Yeah, just exploring and just having my, you know, just exactly, yeah, having some self-worth. And then I'd come back. After a while, I'd start to think, shit, I hope my parents haven't, like, called the police. And I'd come back a few hours later, and they hadn't even noticed I'd gone. So that's what the 70s was like.
Yes, it's true.
Yeah, 70s and 80s, they wouldn't even notice you'd gone.
Have you had any catch-up with any of the people you were at Cardiff High School with?
Yeah.
Did you want to? Did you feel any need for some sort of...
No, I don't feel like... Because
it affects some people forever. But yeah. It doesn't necessarily mean you want to go back and wreak vengeance or forgive or whatever it may be.
Well, actually, my father died a couple of months ago, 2 months ago.
I'm sorry.
He had Alzheimer's. He was very old. So I went back and spent a few days in Cardiff. I went to the funeral, and my closest and probably like really kind of only real friend back then. This guy called Dick Johns he writes stories as well, so he was giving a talk at Chapter Art Centre. So the day after my father's funeral, I went to see Dick doing some talks, and a whole bunch of people from Cardiff High were there. So I did, for the first time in decades, start talking to, you know, kids I knew back then, Beth and Morgan and people like that, and it was kind of slightly odd. It's like, it's, you know, it's no one's fault that, you know, because bullies don't think this is gonna affect you for
sure.
You know, the person that I'm bullying is gonna be living with this for the rest of their lives. So I don't blame them at all. And in fact, Dick and Bethan were two people who didn't bully me.
Right.
But I did walk away feeling very happy to see Dick and Bethan, very pleased to see Dick because he's such a good storyteller. And he was in the office, like he's had some real success in his life.
Yeah.
But also feeling like, kind of, you know, I'm trying to think of the right words. It's not like fuck you, because they didn't like intend to to sort of sully my mental health. But I was sort of quite pleased. Like, yes. You know what? I left Chapter thinking I could actually get sucked back into the psychodrama.
Right.
You know, like when you go back to school you go back home for Christmas,
yes.
And everybody's...
And you resurrect an argument from 1978.
Yeah.
Or, listening to you, I may have misunderstood, it's if you've been dumped and you've had this person in the back of your mind for years and they've never really left the back of your mind. There's always one or two in everybody's life. And then you see him or her and there's nothing. And it's an amazing relief to realise that actually, although there was a big part of your life, it's not as big as it was or as big as it could have been.
That's not what I was thinking.
No,
I was thinking...
One out of two, then, on my insights.
No, it was more... these people still have the power to...
Oh, okay. So you could have gone back down the rabbit hole, as it were.
That's what I was thinking.
Okay.
So I actually got out of Chapter. I really liked seeing Dick's show, but I got out of there quite quickly. That's the truth of it.
What was the talent you had faith in then when you were consoling yourself and during these difficult times with the genuine belief? And I think the bus story is relevant to that because it speaks of escape. It was as if you always had a concept of being able to escape into an interesting world. You might not have known a lot about it, but what was the talent that you felt you had?
Well, when I was 16, my mother kind of convinced me to start volunteering at the local radio station. It was called CBC at the time. I think it's called Red Dragon now. So I started like volunteering there, and there was this DJ called Binder Singh, and he took me under his wing and put me on the air. And I used to like cut together bits of tape.
Physically, with razor blades.
Yeah, literally.
Incredible.
And I actually put together bits of music. At Cardiff High, they were doing something on the dangers of drugs and drinking. So I went into CBC and cut together little bits of songs, like a collage of little bits of songs that were about alcohol or drugs. So acts like at the time it was things like Dr. Feelgood and The Who. And I put them all together and they played it in the assembly. And afterwards people were like, wow, you know, you've got like we still don't like you, but you have a talent. And I just always thought, I did have a talent for writing or for radio or for something like that. Actually, the weird thing about it, though, and I really can't get to grips with this. I'm being completely honest, and I don't think these stories are making me look particularly good, but I'm just being completely honest.
I think they probably are, but...
Right. Well...
Honesty is a good thing.
Well, quite not long ago, when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I had coffee with the former governor of New Jersey, Jim McGreevy. And we got talking about both of us being bullied as kids. He was gay, and that's why he was bullied. And we both got really upset. Yes. And I was sitting thinking to myself, God, I'm in a coffee bar in Manhattan with the former governor of New Jersey. And, and I've done really well in my life. And we're both really shackled by this thing that happened like such a long time ago. Like my bad years of being bullied were from maybe the age of 15 to 18. So 3 years out of my 50 years. I don't understand why it's followed me around like this shadow like my whole life, because I think, you know, my social anxiety comes from it. You know, I get really nervous about going to parties. I tend not to go to parties. I have a kind of lack of self-worth, which only stops being that way when I do good work. You know, so much of my self-worth is kind of wrapped up in the work that I do.
How long does the tank stay full? How long after doing a really... Because, I mean, the project that you've described as being your least favourite, Men Who Stare at Goats, was, for people who aren't aware, it was turned into a film starring George Clooney. So on your kind of, if that's the like, wah-wah on the list of things, all of the others you're clearly much happier with, but how long after, for example, publishing The Psychopath Test in 2011 did you begin to doubt yourself again or not?
Sort of straight away. But really? It's not, yeah, but you know, then you read somebody, like you go on Twitter and somebody's, you know, praising it, and then you feel happy.
To the heavens.
Yeah, so then you sort of feel happy again for a bit. But I never, like, you know, it means that you can't rest on your laurels. Maybe it'll happen one day. Maybe in about 10 or 15 years' time, I'll be able to just relax and look back on things and think it was okay. But right now, the problem is that I asked Randy Newman this question. I made a documentary years ago about Randy Newman called I Am Unfortunately Randy Newman. And I asked him... I asked him why he writes songs, and he said it's how I judge myself and how I feel better.
Okay.
And I remember at the time thinking, you know, that's quite a sad response, but it's completely true of
it's
me.
It's who he is. It's what you are. You can't help it.
Yeah.
So when did that evolve? That you know, that moment in Wales with the splicing of the tapes and the selection of the music and a clever edit and a witty production process, isn't it, that you did?
Yeah.
There's still nothing there that you could have turned into a career. What would you describe as ambition? What was?
Just at the time, just getting out of Cardiff.
Yeah.
But because my mother, you know, sort of forced me to volunteer at the local radio station.
How hard did she have to bend your arm on that? I mean, did she take you to the door of the...
Pretty much, yeah.
Push you in.
Yeah. I wasn't academically gifted. Like, I think I got 7 O-levels and 2 A-levels.
Really?
Yeah. And so my mother kind of thought, you know, the only way he's going to make something out of himself is through some sort of practical experience.
Right.
So she kind of forced me to do it. And she was right.
That's why do you think she thought radio would be a good... Or was there just not a lot of options in Cardiff?
Well, I mean, I definitely glamorised all of that stuff. Like, I would... I remember, like, the age of, like, 4 or 5, like, sitting there listening to John Peel and the Radio 1 chart show and pretending, you know, daydreaming, you know, that I was the person on the radio introducing the songs. And then... The Chapter Arts Centre, which was like my saviour in Cardiff, I'd go there and see... I remember the double bills, like, you know, I remember seeing a double bill of Scorsese's King of Comedy and Woody Allen's Zelig. And you know, really loving it, like clutching hold of these things. It's like, you know, it's like a kind of, you know, like a
proof.
Life, yeah.
Proof that you were bigger than.
Yeah, proof that there was life outside.
Yeah, being, and that you got it as well in a way that some of the people at school wouldn't have done it. In a,
maybe, or certainly, or just there was a world. It was like a glimmer into a world outside Cardiff High and outside Cardiff. And this makes me sound anti-Cardiff, by the way, which I'm not at all.
Keep worrying about how you're sounding. I promise you that you're sounding neither anti-Cardiff nor right. unlikable. I promise.
Yeah,
you.
And I'm not anti-Cardiff at all. Like you know, when I went back for my father's funeral a few months ago, you know, other than the fact that my father had died and it was very sad, it was nice to see my old, you know, to see Dick again. We went to the Chlanisha Golf Club, which was where the service was after the funeral.
And it's home.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I wouldn't go that far. But I was thinking it's very pretty, like rolling hills. It's like upstate New York.
It's very pretty. Back to your mum shoving you through the door of the radio station. It going well. You've been taken under wings, but still not a career in there.
Well, I got it. It got me a place at the Polytechnic of Central London to do media studies, do journalism.
Which at the time was one of probably only two such courses in the country.
And it was hugely
absolutely.
Somebody told me there was I think they accepted 30 people a year and there was 3,000 people applying.
That sounds feasible.
Yeah. My fellow alumni, I think they came just before me was Michael Jackson, who ended up being the head of the BBC and Channel 4. Just after me was Charlie Brooker and Danny Wallace and my friend Emmy the Great, the singer. So, you know, produce some really good people.
Evidently.
And I tell you, the second my mother dropped me off at the Halls residence on Bolsover Street, my life just transformed.
Really?
Yeah, I'd just turned 18 and my mother dropped me off and I went into the Halls residence and the guy in the next room, his name was Dippin Joshi, said, "Oh, good, don't come for a drink." And that second, my life just transformed. I went from...
Oh, that's magic.
Yeah, being really... And honestly, other than my anxiety, my life's been really great.
Had you suspected? Because those 3 years, lots of people get bullied, rarely for that long, and those 3 years are so formative. Mm. Had you suspected that, because you mentioned Zelig and King of Comedy giving you a window on another world, did you almost fantasize about a world where people were a bit more like you, or at least, you know, where you had friends and you had a social circle and you could talk about all the stuff that you found interesting without pretending that you found the stuff everybody else found interesting?
Absolutely. And college gave me all of that. The other thing I was doing around the same time when I was 17 was I was going off on my own to Edinburgh and just hanging out with...
To the festival.
Yeah, and basically just sitting there to this day you will see awkward people just like me at the age of 17 sitting in comedy clubs, just sitting and staring.
Drinking
it in, and I was one of those people. I remember I wonder if he remembers this. I remember Mark Thomas coming up to me really crossly in the late 80s or mid to late 80s. I was like, "I see you." He said to me "I see you, at these clubs, I've seen you all the time and you just sit there and you're not doing anything. When are you going to do something?" And I remember that as a real kind of
you're already an undergraduate by this point.
Or maybe I hadn't even gone to college yet. I was just like a comedy
When are you
fan.
Going to do something?
Yeah. And
had you asked yourself that at that point?
I wonder why Mark Thomas
picked
up on it, but he did. And I have no idea if he remembers that, but that was definitely a moment when I thought...
He's quite an intuitive person, Mark Thomas, isn't he? And he's possessed of epic levels of compassion as well. I think the first time I met him, they were telling me about a time that him and some of the other comedians from that era had done a benefit and he couldn't remember whether they'd given the money to the miners or the dockers after the payment. So he's looking at other people's experiences in a way that some comedians are too solipsistic to do. So perhaps he just saw something above your head, a miasma of unfulfilled promise.
Yeah, and it certainly motivated me.
Did it?
Yeah.
And what did it... I mean, because I still... Early days, what... what would be the outlet for all of these almost like gathering forces within you?
Well, what happened was after 2 years of college, where I just bummed around, and but I needed to. I was like, I realized that if you wanted to have a good life in London, you needed to live in a squat, because if you were renting on a student loan, student grant.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
In those days, you'd have to live in that Turnham Green. And then there'd be like, you know, you'd be travelling back and forth.
I currently live in Turnham Green.
Oh, really?
It's changed a lot, right. I promise you.
I'm not dissing Turnham Green, I'm dissing the travel time.
Any more than
time.
You were Cardiff. Right. No, I grant you, but you'd struggle to live in Turnham Green on a student grant these days.
Right. That's
just for any estate agents listening. So you had to live in a squat, so you had a disposable income.
Yeah, exactly. So in Scotland, so there was this guy called Mark Cornes, who was like, people say, see that guy over there? He's Mark Cornes. He's like involved in the Squatters Network. So I plucked up the courage to go up to Mark Cornes and say, you know, I hear that, you know where people can squat. And he was like, yeah. So I started squatting, and I squatted in Highbury and Islington and Bayswater. Some of my contemporaries were like squatting. I remember the Libyan embassy got squatted, and people who I knew were squatting the Libyan embassy. So we were living in these like beautiful
mansions,
townhouses.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, they were rats. That was the downside, but we weren't paying rent, so we could hardly complain. So for a couple of years, I just bummed around in squats and, you know, being hedonistic. And then I met two people. I met this band called The Man from Del Monte, and I met Frank Sidebottom and his like crew. And they both kind of convinced me, because I was the social secretary at the Polytechnic. After 2 years of college, I became the social secretary.
Which means you book the acts and you run the kind of gig side of the college life.
I used to book a comedy show every week called Frank's Wild Tuesdays. And we had Jerry Sadowitz, we had Vic Reeves before he was Vic and Bob.
Yeah.
That's how early it was. And all the great comedians of the time like did our thing, and I was less good at booking bands because I didn't have any kind of particular musical aptitude, but I met Frank Sidebottom and I met The Man from Del Monte, and they both said to me, you should move to Manchester. Frank was like, come and be in the band, and The Man from Del Monte was like, come and manage us. So I quit college and moved to Manchester, and when I was in Manchester, I started writing for the local listings magazine, City Life. I was already writing for the college newspaper in London.
What year would this be, roughly?
87. So just before Manchester.
You never did theatre reviews, did you?
No, I
didn't. Because I got a stinker in 1988 from City Life in
Manchester, really?
for a show I did with the youth theatre. I was just double-checking. So was that the first time you got money for journalism, then?
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember my college lecturer, David Cardiff, who was this incredibly brilliant and charismatic man. He was married to Lynn Barber.
Oh, wow, yes.
Yeah, and he died. He died really young. He died in his 50s. And he said to me, he took me for coffee, and he said, you are the only person who writes for the college magazine who's got any writing talent.
Wow. Did you believe him?
Yeah. So Mark Thomas saying that to me,
yes,
and David Cardiff saying that to me, were really important. Like, it was the first praise I ever really had. So when I moved to Manchester, I started writing for City Life. I was getting paid like 40 quid for a film review. And it just was obvious that was what I was cracked up to do.
And from the local press in Manchester, straight to The Guardian?
Pretty much, yeah. Yes. I got,
because your talent was spotted.
Yeah, well, what happened?
Are you good at knocking on doors, John? Are you good at
it? Yes. Well, I don't enjoy it because I'm introverted.
Of course.
But I'm good at it.
Okay.
Being a journalist, you have to be like a hustler, yes, in every way. To get the story, to get the story placed, you know, you have to be a hustler. You have to be this tireless hustler. Mm. So I've always been that. Actually, between City Life and The Guardian, I worked for a local radio station. The other person to take me under his wing was Terry Christian.
Crikey.
From The Word.
Really?
Yeah. He was presenting the show.
Another generous man.
Yeah, he was really generous. Mm. He basically got me a job at the local radio station, KFM. And then when he went off and did The Word, I took over his show. And I would co-present with Craig Cash and Caroline Hearn.
Seriously?
Yeah. So good, the three of us, me, Craig and Caroline, were doing these late night shows. And we all got fired one day because we were too niche, basically.
Right.
So we all got fired. And that's how I got work down in London, because there was this big campaign to get us reinstated. So suddenly Time Out and The Guardian were like aware of us. It was like a bit of a, it was noise, like these three sort of maverick people up in Manchester had been, like, you know, cruelly fired. There were like newspaper articles about it, and I think that helped all of us, actually.
Yes, so you rode that wave of
as did Craig and Caroline.
Absolutely.
And they went off and did Mrs. Merton, and I went down to London and started working for like Time Out and The Guardian, and then eventually the BBC.
Did you have in your mind an idea of the kind of journalist you wanted to be, or were you trying lots of different things in the smorgasbord of the media and deciding what you wanted to focus
on? The latter, although it wasn't lots of things, it was one thing.
Yes.
I was a big fan of Victor Lewis Smith,
yes,
and Hunter S. Thompson and P.J. O'Rourke.
The Gonzo.
Yeah, the Gonzo.
Phrase.
And Victor,
what does that mean for people who haven't heard the word before? How would you?
I guess it means, you know, first, like, adventures where you are the first person, you know, where you're part of the story as the writer, obviously,
rather than the outsider observing.
Yeah, but the other thing that they were was kind of acerbic. I mean, like, Victor was kind of cruel,
vicious.
Yeah. And so for a while, I kind of pretended to be vicious.
Did that come easily to you?
Yeah, but it was kind of fake. Like, I was good at being...
playing a character.
Yeah.
Like Craig Cash and Caroline.
Yeah, it really was. I remember, do you know the playwright Terry Johnson?
Yes.
Yeah, great playwright. Anyway, I wanted to interview him one time for something, and he told me afterwards that the only reason why he wanted to meet me was to find out if I was as vicious in real life as I was on the page. So that's how vicious I was.
And of course you weren't. You were nowhere near as vicious in real life, were you?
Nowhere near. Terry Johnson told me that he was disappointed.
I was going to say, what an anticlimax.
Yeah, he said that to me. It's anticlimactic meeting you. You're just this kind of soft liberal.
So you could, I often wonder, I don't know whether you've given this any thought, but the people who are professionally vile, which is probably a more lucrative branch of the media in this country at this point in time than it was when you were on the way up. But the people who are professionally vile, I often wonder if they started off doing it as an act and actually realised it was more lucrative than anything else they had in their arsenal.
I'm not, you know, when you're in this bubble of British media, I think you don't realise that the kind of oppositional sort of viciousness of the British media is not, that doesn't happen all over the world. That's quite a British thing.
Mm.
And in some ways it's good, of course. In other ways, it's not so good. It's not so good for someone like me. Like, on the very, very rare occasions, on the, you know, vanishingly rare occasions that I'll do a show like Have I Got News For You?
Yes.
It's not good because it's like a bad one night stand, because I just don't thrive in that kind of, you know, oppositional.
That's not that oppositional either. I did a bit of a humble, but I did it for the first time last month. And I didn't even think it was... I forgot it was a competition until they read out the scores at the end. I was just desperately trying to make Paul Merton like me.
Okay.
Well, I dedicated myself to that.
Well, Ian Hislop kind of had it in for me a little
bit. Did he?
Yeah, I don't quite... It came as a surprise.
Yeah, well, then again, I suppose he is a Blades exposed type of performer, isn't he?
But I much prefer something more...
contemplative.
Yeah, and empathetic and curious,
yes.
And you know, and also giving people the space to think and talk. So yeah, so I suppose what sort of turned me into the writer that I became,
John Ronson that I am today.
Yeah, I became a really big fan of Nick Broomfield.
Right, he's a sort of documentary maker who again immerses himself in his subject in a way that was, if not unprecedented, then certainly very, very, very rare.
Yeah, Nick too was quite sort of passive aggressive. I mean, we all were at the time. Like me, Nick, Louis Theroux.
Yes,
you know, we all sort of did that.
And did you mix?
Yeah.
I know Louis. I don't know Nick Broomfield. He stood behind me once. I was toying with the idea of making a documentary about the Daily Express.
Okay.
And the editor, Rosie Boycott, was friends with him.
Mm-hmm.
So he came in and got assigned to my department and just sat behind us grunting all day.
Oh, really?
And just sort of barking quite aggressive questions at us and things like that. And I'm not sure he came away with a full picture of. So were you the three names you mentioned, you, Theroux and Broomfield, would you have seen yourselves as part of the same movement?
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, as a joke one time, Sight and Sound asked me to write an essay about the movement. So as a joke, I gave us a name, like a French name. I said we were Les Nouvelles Egotistes. And on Wikipedia, still there on Wikipedia, even though I was kidding.
I'm looking that up.
Yeah.
Really, it's been left up there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's better. Isn't that brilliant? And that was an attempt to be part of the story and be part of the
Yeah. But I think process. We all changed. So we all started off with that sort of air of moral superiority, like Nick was better than South African neo-Nazis,
yes.
You know, Louis was better than the Ku Klux Klan, I was better than Islamic fundamentalists. But I think all three of us changed. Like, and I think we all realised that being curious and empathetic and compassionate ultimately makes for like better stories. And I can't tell you sort of why they changed. Because, so for instance, Nick's film, his most recent film about Whitney Houston is very, you know, it's really good and it's very sweet and very compassionate. Louis's best stuff, I think, is, I mean, I really like Louis's stuff, and my favourite of Louis's stuff is when he's much more curious and compassionate too. And
there's the daughter of the Baptist, what's the something Borough Baptist Church?
Oh, yeah, Megan Phelps.
Yes, that's an astonishing relationship that he has with her, isn't it?
He just
really cares about her. It's clear to see.
Funny
rather
enough,
than sort of standing back and going,
Yeah. I've got to know Megan pretty well. Yeah. When Say You've Been Publicly Shamed came out, I got approached by the most unexpected people, people who'd been shamed,
yes.
Or people who were feeling guilty about things they'd done in their lives. And some of them have become friends, and Megan Phelps is one of them. We're pretty good friends.
She's in a better place now.
Oh, she's a great person. She's about to be a really big star because Nick Hornby's writing a movie based on her life.
Oh wow.
Yeah, that Reese Witherspoon's company's making. So Megan's about to become like this big and right, she's an amazing person, I guess.
Well, when you made your first, what was the first film that you made then? Was that
The first proper film I made was with Saul Dibb. It was called New York to California, A Great British Odyssey. And it was a road journey from New York, which is a little village in Norfolk, to a caravan site called California Sands a few miles down the road, and we basically did this entire journey, this hour-long film of the two of us on the road on this very short journey.
How did you pitch that? Or was it one of those occasions where you'd been trusted enough to
there was one no one trusted us,
no,
but
can't think why.
Just one person who's the commissioning editor for religion at the time, Peter Grimsdale at Channel 4. And he really liked us, and he put me and Saul together, and we made New York to California, and then we made, the following year, we made Tottenham Ayatollah, which was my Amabaku film, and that was the film that sort of really launched me and Saul.
Into a whole new level. We'll talk about the butterfly effect now, but before, just one other thing, that again, looking back, and I know you won't have seen these, but the previous guest on Unfiltered whose story tallies the most with yours, oddly, is Armando Iannucci.
Really?
Not only because his first ever kind of exposure to the media was cutting stuff up with razor blades and splicing together his own projects, but also, I mean, perhaps even more bizarrely, when he ended up coming to London and meeting up with other people that some producers thought he might be able to collaborate with, he ended up meeting people like Steve Coogan.
And
you ended up meeting people like Carolina Hearn and Craig Cash.
Yeah.
And the word that he used was serendipity. He feels lucky while describing to my mind, he was describing a talent that was always going to be discovered. He still felt lucky that it had been. I'd love to know how lucky you feel, because you simultaneously had this security blanket in Cardiff of thinking, I am, but it's not a word you'd have used, but I'm going to use it. I am better than this, or at least I'm bigger than this. And yet having the anxiety. So how much of a role do you think luck has played in what you've described as a very successful career?
It's a really good question, because, like, you know, certainly certain really lucky things happened to me. People in high positions sort of spotted me and decided to give me a chance. So the people that I mentioned, plus there was a magazine at the time called The Sunday Correspondent.
Yes.
Yeah, and the editor, Ian Parker, kind of gave me a chance. Chris Heath on Smash Hits gave me a chance. So I feel very lucky that they all kind of saw the promise in me.
But there was still the promise there. That's the point.
Yeah, there was, you know, there was the promise there.
Do you think there's any great undiscovered talents that tried and failed to get into the kind of businesses you've been in?
I mean, you hope not, because you want the world to be egalitarian and a true meritocracy. But sometimes I fear that's not true. I think, you know, being talented isn't enough. You have to put yourself out there. You have to be this kind of tireless hustler.
Mm.
You need both. So there are, I'm sure, and I know one or two of them, like really, really talented people who didn't make it because they didn't knock on doors and they didn't put themselves out.
It's funny, Robert Webb spoke about being in his late 20s, and him and David Mitchell had cracked the writing side of it, but it was beginning to look as if they were never going to break through on the performance side of it. And that, I think, would have consigned him to a life of feeling that he'd never quite crossed over the line.
Right.
What was it? Was it that first Omar Bakri film that made you feel you'd, all right, I'm over the line now. This is where I want to be. And now it's up to me to consolidate and build on this, but this is where I want to be.
That film really kind of was important. It coincided with these little Hi8 cameras coming out, tiny little cameras. And that meant me and Saul could be, we could just go out and do it, you know. It was almost like an early form of, like, you know, podcasting or blogging. Mm. Like we didn't have to wait for anybody to give us permission. We could just go out and film. These cameras cost nothing. You know, you didn't need a crew. So, and Tottenham Ayatollah was the first, I think, other than this series at the time called Video Diaries, it was the first film ever shot on one of those little cameras to go on sort of mainstream TV at 9 o'clock at night. And it became very influential for that.
For sure.
Because we really, you know, we managed to sort of infiltrate this very closed world of Islamic militants, people who it turned out would end up committing acts of terrorism. And we would never have managed it if we didn't look like scruffy students and we didn't have a tiny little camera. So it was a really influential film in that way, in the technological way as well.
And when we track the journey from one project to the next, the butterfly effect has its origins in So You've Been Shamed.
Yeah.
Because you were interviewing a pornographic actress while writing that book, and clocked the Chateau Marmont, I think, wasn't it? Did I pronounce that correctly?
The Chateau, I say the Chateau Marmont, but I think some people say Marmont.
You clocked that while she was dressed in a way that at work gets her the right kind of attention, outside of work, in the environment in which you met her, you were struck by how people reacted to
her. Yeah, so I was meeting, I'd never met a porn star before. I was in my room at the Chateau Marmont. And by the way, the first time I was supposed to meet her, she just completely forgot, and I was sitting in a restaurant for like 3 hours.
No.
Yeah, and finally I went on Twitter, and I went on her Twitter feed, and she just, and like 2 hours earlier, she tweeted, "I know I'm supposed to do something. Why have I got that?" She'd completely forgotten. Anyway, so then the next day she came to the lobby of the hotel, and the receptionist said, "Your guest is waiting for you downstairs." And so I went downstairs. And everyone else was dressed like I'm dressed in, like, you know, inconspicuous introvert, the clothing of the media introvert, except for Donna, who was dressed in this bright blue dress and looked, you know, incredible, looked like this kind of great mad peacock, you know, with a face that you just, like, you know, she'd seen some things,
yes,
you know?
Yes.
She had stories to tell. She'd lived an amazing life in a shadowy world. you know, she was hugely intriguing to me. So I walked towards her and I looked over at the receptionist and he was looking at her with a look of contempt, disgust. Yeah. Like, what are you, what is someone like you doing at this hotel? And I thought to myself, you know, I bet you watch porn and I bet you're fine with Princess Donna when she's on your computer. Mm. And that gave me the spark of wanting to do a show about porn, which then turned into a show about the butterfly effect of the tech takeover of the porn industry.
Did you know at that moment that you were going to have a proper look at doing something bigger? I'm fascinated by your creative process.
I think so. I think that look definitely stayed with me. And I think once I'd finished So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I was thinking, what am I going to do next?
Yes.
And I remembered that look. What happened next was I started reading blogs by porn people. Mm. I just started meeting porn people. I met Stoyer, I met Chanel Preston. These are like big names in porn, and they all agreed to meet me.
Yes.
And
did they know your work?
Chanel Preston did, because she's friends with this guy, Connor Habib, who's a gay porn star. Right. He's a fan of mine.
Okay.
He tweeted me one time and said, you know, I'm a fan of yours. I'm a gay porn star. If you want to know more about my work, just Google me. Mm. So I Googled him and just immediately saw these, you know, massive close-ups of his anus.
Such history must be a thing to behold.
And he came to one of my talks in a bookstore in Los Angeles, and I told that story, and he was in the audience, and he just went, "You're welcome."
Brilliant.
Brilliant. So she knew who I was, and I was just sort of thinking, what story could I possibly do about porn?
Yes.
And then I started reading blogs by people like Stoyer, and the same name kept coming up, which was Fabian, and the porn world was very annoyed with a man called Fabian. So I started trying to find out who's Fabian, and it turns out that Fabian's the man who basically became hugely rich from giving the world free porn on sites like Pornhub. And a giant flow of money went from the San Fernando Valley into Fabian's pocket.
Specifically into his.
Yeah.
Because he was a tech entrepreneur who just spotted a...
He spotted that, unusually for porn, they were behind the curve,
right,
when it came to tech.
Normally they push the technology to its limits.
Exactly,
don't they?
But not with the internet. You know, YouTube was already going,
yeah,
and nobody had thought, let's do YouTube for porn. So Fabian essentially did it.
And that is, it seems to me, these are the moments where you feel like you're panning for gold, and you see this name keeps coming up, because you use the phrase the tech takeover of porn. At this point, before you started coming across his name in these blogs, you didn't know there'd been a tech takeover.
Didn't know anything about it, so it's almost like these things
start coalescing,
yeah,
in your mind, and you think, this is a story that no one else has told. And that's the first point at which you think, this could,
yes,
be my next project.
It was hiding in plain sight.
That's the phrase.
The fact that nobody else had told this story, that's always really important to me. I always, yes, want to tell a story that other people don't do, which has its pitfalls too, because, like, I would really love to do all this sexual predator stuff that's happening, but I worry about it because of the competition I'd be in with other journalists, and because I'm slow.
Right.
So it does cut down, like, wanting to do a story that nobody else does cut down my possibilities.
Because you're interested in things that have been told, and you might have something new to say about them, but you as you say...
it'd be stressful, because,
yes,
I'm slow, you know, and whereas people on the New York Times, they're fast.
Right.
So, yeah. My real epiphany was on the set of Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy.
Okay.
Where a couple of things happened which were just astonishing to me. There's a few days in my life where, like, everything changed. And one of them was when I was writing Them, and I suddenly had this brainwave. They all, you know, these conspiracy theorists all believe that there's a secret room, you know, inside which a shadowy cabal secretly,
yes,
rules the world.
Yes.
Why don't I hook up with them and we'll try and find the secret room?
Yes.
So that was one real epiphany.
Yeah.
And then my another epiphany was all these leading psychologists believe that psychopaths rule the world. There's a particular mental disorder that's so powerful, it rules the world. Why don't I learn how to be a psychopath spotter and journey into the corridors of power? And that's what gave me the idea to write the psychopath test. And another epiphany happened on the set of Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy. Yeah, it was when the second cameraman, it's very rare for there to be a second cameraman on,
right,
porn sets these days, because all the money's gone to Fabian to spend on his aquarium that's so big, it's got his own diver. But But the second cameraman, Nate, said to me, rare day for me shooting real porn. So I was like, well, what do you do normally? And he said, customs.
Right.
And I said, what's customs? And he said, oh, bespoke porn. We make entire porn films for just one viewer. So when Nate told me that, I was like, I'm going to get into bespoke porn world. Because what an insight into people's inner lives.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And some of the inner lives that you unearth are staggering. It's a 7-part audio series that you've done with Audible. So it's available on iTunes and all the other outlets.
Yeah.
How do you decide what medium to employ for a project? I mean, why not a book? There'll probably be a book, will there, on this?
Or? I'm not sure, actually.
There you go, then. So there isn't. Yeah. Nothing. I can take nothing for granted. How come? Yeah. Why for this one? A 7-part audio series.
Well, a few things happened. Firstly, I noticed I was listening more and more to podcasts.
Yes.
And I've always... So here's a tip, actually, for kind of budding, you know, journalists. I think it's always a really good idea to try and work for people that you yourself are a consumer of, because there'll be a kind of shared...
Yes.
Interest. And right from the beginning, you know, I wanted to work for Time Out because I liked Time Out. Same with The Guardian, same with Channel 4. And these days it's podcasting and Audible. Like I listen to audiobooks more than I read physical books.
Okay.
And also lots of people listen to me on audiobook instead of reading my books.
Mm.
So when Audible came along and said, do you fancy doing, you know, we want to branch out into kind of original stuff. It helped that they had a budget.
Yes, of course.
Most podcast companies don't have much money, and I work in such a kind of labor-intensive way. I need money. You know, I'll fly all the way to Los Angeles for what will turn out to be 50 seconds of material.
Yes.
So I need somebody who's willing to spend that kind of money on the show. And really, there might be other companies, but the only two companies I can think of that have that kind of money are Audible and This American Life.
Mm.
So it all sort of all just came together.
Blade.
And my American publisher said to me, I don't want you to write a book that's about porn.
Well, because?
He said it will really cut down. You know, he basically, you know, he felt, and I, you know, I think he's probably right.
Yes.
He felt that I'm not going to, in America, it's really important to get on Fresh Air with Terry Gross.
Right, you are.
Or to get on Morning Edition or...
Yes.
You know, these big NPR shows.
And they're not
going
to invite you on to talk about...
To talk about porn.
Or
so,
cheerleader
team. Stepdaughter team. Audrey. As it turned out, actually, the Butterfly Effect has been a hit.
Yes, precisely.
Yeah.
A big hit.
Yeah, but whether it would have been a big hit as a book, Jeff may well have been right.
And also, it keeps you fresh. New platforms, new media. I mean, you know...
It was real fun as well.
Yes.
Bringing out Say You've Been Publicly Shamed was not fun.
Why not?
It was noisy. Like, everyone had an opinion.
Yeah, of course. And everything in it was contentious. It was an ongoing fight, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was an ongoing argument.
Exactly. So... I also wanted to do something that was more fun. And I thought, correctly as it turned out, that doing a podcast with my producer, Lena, Mesitzis, would be more fun.
And I've been, you're here to encourage people to go and listen to it. So I don't want to exhaustively explore what's in it. But I think you're right to cite the notion of customs as being the most interesting discovery.
Yeah. But other really, really interesting stuff like... Well, one of my favourite things, in fact, the thing that stays with me is the most resonant. Again, it happened on the set of Stepdaughter Cheerleader Orgy, where the director said to me, you know, I never used to make films with titles like that. I was like, what did your films used to be called? And he said, the very first porn film I ever made was called Women of Influence.
Good grief.
And the problem is that because of the tech takeover of porn, it's become like an arms race of search engine optimization.
Yeah.
Everybody has to pile as many keywords into their film titles as possible, like Stepdaughter, Cheerleader and Orgy, to kind of, you know, get their way up the Google search rankings. So I said to Mike, does that mean there's people who fall between the keyword cracks, who can't get work? And he was like, yes, if you're a 25-year-old adult film actress, you're basically unemployable because you're too old to be a teen and you're too young to be a MILF. You're just attractive, and just attractive isn't a searchable term.
And yet once, that would have been the key demographic of porno stars.
Yeah. So I was thinking, like, that's the internet all over, right?
Yeah,
isn't that political
isn't
discourse
it?
On Twitter if you're not a teen
and
you're not a MILF, if you're not like a kind of lunatic.
That's incredible.
So I identify with the 25-year-old adult film actress as a kind of left-leaning moderate. I'm not a teen.
Then there's the saturation element as well. So they can have months of... or weeks even of a decent earning, and then suddenly, because of the nature of the internet, they're everywhere, and there's no need to pay them to do anything else ever again.
Yeah, and the valley's just inundated with 18-year-old, you know, women who've grown up on Pornhub and think that looks cool. Mm. You know, there's no longer an outlaw status to porn. And of course, in some ways, you know, if somebody doesn't believe in stigma,
sure,
that's good. But in another ways, it's bad because it means their shelf life is incredibly short. They, you know, unless you could somehow cut through, and some women do. There's a woman called Janice Griffiths who's a big star now. And so some women cut through, but most work for 3 weeks, don't work anymore, go back to where they came from, and now have to live in terror that...
You examine this as well. You have one girl who finds out her mum has been doing porn because the films some of her classmates see. A nurse
on Pornhub.
A nurse who loses his job.
Yeah.
Who'd given up.
Because hypocrisy over and over again, you know, it's hypocrisy.
And the custom stuff, I mean, to give the kind of headline examples, there's one man in Norway pays
porn stars to destroy his very valuable stamp collection. So me and Lena became like obsessed with, like, you know, tracking down Stamps Man, tracking down Condiments Man, Gremlins Man, to find out their stories, like what led them to this moment.
How much is Fabian worth now? Do we know?
I don't know, but I do know that he's got his own diver who comes to clean his coral reef in his aquarium. As this artist, Bob Gibson, said to me, who'd visited Fabian's house, he said, that's next level, isn't it?
Every time I meet you, I always ask what you're going to do next. I'm not sure you've ever told me. Do you know?
Yeah, I can't give you that, the details. But the other thing I did this year was I co-wrote with Bong Joon-ho the movie Okja Netflix. And it was kind of a hit. Well, it was a pit.
Massive
I didn't even need to say kind of.
No,
it was a hit.
Huge.
And as a result, I've been offered a couple of screenplays. So even though it's out of my comfort zone, like I feel very confident in nonfiction and much less confident in fiction, I'm going to spend the next year working on these screenplays.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Couple of for the company A24 who gave the world Moonlight, and they're just about to bring out this film which I would recommend to everybody, called Lady Bird, which is starring Saoirse Ronan and directed by Greta Gerwig. They're such a great independent film company, so I feel very lucky that they've taken an interest in me.
And I would recommend The Butterfly Effect similarly to everybody, and also all of, I'm not going to lie to you, I haven't read Club Class, but all of John's other work, Them, Adventures with Extremists, The Men Who Stare at Goats, The Psychopath Test, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and now, as we say, The Butterfly Effect. I unreservedly recommend every single one of them. John Ronson, thank you so much.
James, it was such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And as is the tradition by this point in the series, I'm joined now by the producer of Unfiltered, Rich, to sort of cast a quick glance into the rearview mirror. I every single time I interview John, and it's only 3 or 4 times, I don't want to make it sound like I've done it 100 times, I find that we reach the end of our allotted time together and think that we could have carried on for 5 times longer. And that was an hour. That's the longest time I've ever had with him. And I still got to the end and felt, crikey, we did more than scratch the surface, though, I think.
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting to hear him on the other end of the Inquisition. And he's really open and honest and seemed like forthcoming, like as you would hope, because that's what he expects of the people he talks to. So
there were a couple of moments where I wondered whether he felt he was being too forthcoming. There were a couple of moments where he sort of seemed to think he was being a bit too honest.
Where? What do you think?
I think he was worried about the talking about his childhood stuff. I don't know whether he was worried that he was giving up too much of himself, or he was worried that he was sounding a little bit, when he says he wanted to stress that he wasn't slagging off Cardiff and he wanted to make sure that he was coming across in the way he wanted to come across as, which I think is part of his genius, actually, is that constant blend of vulnerability and fearlessness.
Yeah, and care.
Care,
at the same time,
yeah,
he really cares about the people that he talks to, and that comes across in The Butterfly Effect. You know, like he was saying, when people approach those kind of topics, they sometimes do it from a position of moral superiority, and he absolutely doesn't do that. You know, he's like buckets of empathy, really.
Yes.
Cares about these people and cares about their stories, which is why I think he is the kind of person that he is and kind of journalist that he is.
I'm going to go and dig out that article he wrote pretending that him, Louis Theroux and Nick Broomfield were the Les Nouvelles egotistes.
Send me it, will you?
You're listening to Unfiltered with James O'Brien, brought to you by Joe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.